Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. You can also check us out on the website at beekeepingfornewbies.com, same site, and bestbeekeepinggear.com. We got some different reviews and things on there, particularly not so much reviews right now, but more just tips, pointers, tricks around Varroa management and must-have items for beekeepers and all kinds of fun stuff there. And of course, we're over at YouTube, youtube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. A couple things that might be applicable there. There's videos that we have that are about, you know, new beekeepers getting set up, like what type of hive options do you have, things you may want to consider. We have the video around how much does it cost to keep beekeeping. I think I have one video called 5 Reasons You Shouldn't Be a Beekeeper. So there's some things in there. And it's not like I'm trying to pick on anybody. It's just like, hey, if you have a job and you travel all the time and can't do inspections, maybe not the best fit. Things like that. Lots of cool videos on there. Some of them are just, you know, short and silly. And some of them are a little more interesting. I do like the one with the $17 microphone and taking notes using ChatGPT. That's where I basically use the cheap mic, talk about my hive inspection while I'm doing it. And then I take those notes and do a transcription of the audio to text, let, you know, ChatGPT catalog it for me, and it's pretty handy. So I got a whole video on exactly how I do that and where I found the mic and all those kind of things. Today's warm-up song is He Went to Paris by my good buddy James Buffet, or as the common folk call him, Jimmy Buffett. And remember, if you're a rum drinker, be sure to take a drink every time you hear a JB song. Unless you have an alcohol problem, then just have a Mick Ultra. That's actually a joke from the show Landman. So if you haven't seen Landman, it's pretty good. It's solid. Definitely worth checking out. All right. One last note before we get in here, because this is going to be Bee Buzz 30, episode 178. I wanted to let you know that Peg DeSanto, we had her on, if the name doesn't ring a bell, she was on episodes 175 and 176 talking about condensing hives and overwintering strategies, insulation, all kinds of really cool things. If you haven't listened to those, go back and check out 175 and 176. But she's the co-founder of Hive Hugger. And if you go to hivehugger.com and you're looking to place an order for anything on there, she has extended that discount code of all caps, BK4N. So it's BK, the number 4, and N as in November, all capitalized. She has extended that discount code that she's offering through the end of the year. So be sure to go over there and check that out if that's something that you would be interested in. All right, we have this list that's been running for probably about a month now. I think I'm at a point where I can kind of catch up. I do have a chance here to run through this and hopefully get it all done. I don't even have that many questions here, but as you all know, I do have a tendency to kind of go off on tangents and my ADD kicks in. Like, I didn't tell you guys yet about the cat, like the update on the cat. He's down to like, he's around 4 pounds right now. And like every part of him that he licks, like after they eat, they kind of like lick their paws and give themselves like a cat shower. Like everywhere he licks, he's like losing his hair. Like he's just, everything's falling apart. We know he's on life support and, you know, what can you do? But we found a food combination that he's eating, and he's eating like a horse. He won't stop eating, but he's a trooper. But that's the kind of sidetrack stuff that I do all the time. So I think we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's only like 9 questions. So I feel like with 9 questions, we should be able to work through this. And I'm also going to take a quick look over at the Discord room before I wrap up and make sure that I didn't miss any new questions that may have popped up. Okay, so what's the latest I can safely treat for Varroa mites before winter? I don't know if there is a textbook answer. Like, I don't know if the makers of various oxalic acid compounds have stated anything around, hey, recommended usage between this temperature range or whatever. I can tell you what I've done. I hate to be a person who does something wrong and then tells you that it's okay to do so. I have a pretty temperate climate. Like, even, I mean, yes, it does get kind of like air quotes, like really cold here sometimes. But I mean, even on a, you know, most average winter days for us are probably like in the high 30s, low 40s Fahrenheit. So like 3 to 5 Celsius, something like that. It's just not that cold. So what I really don't know is if I tell you, like, I've treated at all months, literally all months of the year I've treated before, and then for some reason that's not a good thing to do below a certain temperature, I wouldn't want to misguide you or mislead you on that. What I can tell you is that I have treated literally at every month in the year. I had a couple things I was playing around with, and I should have done this in some more of a scientific and kind of has some kind of methodology behind it. But I just had this idea one year. Well, what if I just vaporize them while they're in the cluster, you know, every like once a month? So November, December, January, February, just hit them every month. Why not? The problem is I don't know. Like, was everything okay when I sent them into overwinter in November and they didn't need that? Or did them being in the cluster, did that interfere with anything? Did it make anything worse? I had no real way of testing it. So I can't honestly tell you if it's a good or bad thing to do. My mindset is kind of like if you had four hives of the same genetics and things are roughly the same. So maybe you take one of them, you stop the treatments in November and you don't treat again until, you know, February, March or April. Then you take the second one and maybe you treat that one every month. So you do November, December, January, February, March. And then maybe you do your first mite wash in March or April when you can get into the hive and really look at things. And then maybe you have the other two that you do, you know, maybe you alternate every other month. I don't know exactly the most scientific way to do that because you can't get in and assess things. Like if it were a warm time where you could safely open the hive and take out frames and do a wash and then say, wow, look at this broodless period. Because remember, broodless periods are a great time to treat with oxalic acid. And that's, let me step back real quick. I probably should have mentioned this early on. Most of the treatments that are in the hive are going to be something that requires the bees to interact with them, obviously, right? If they don't interact with them, there's not a lot of way to treat unless it specifically targets whatever the bug or the mite or whatever it might be, the parasite. So when you're using the strips, it kind of counts on the bees walking across the strips. You know, if you're using the oxalic acid vapor, it counts on the vapor moving through and then sticking to the bees. If you look at other things that are vapor-based, like your formic and other things that create a vapor, it would need to then move throughout and make contact with. So something obviously like formic, you know, where it has its more strict temperature range, you wouldn't use that. Oxalic acid is what I was kind of thinking of when I was talking about this, but you also have to remember too that if you have a big tight cluster and you get all the treatment is around the outside, how much of it gets to the inside? That would be a question to ask. And then, of course, any types of strips require the bees to move across them, which they really aren't doing. So most of the treatment methods probably won't have any efficacy or very little. But if I did anything, like I said, I have in the past done the vapor. I just didn't measure it. So I really wouldn't recommend it unless the scenario that I would recommend, let's say you're going into the fall and you've been doing everything you can to get the mites under control. Maybe you hit them with something more aggressive. And you got a good knockdown and they're on the right track, but you're just really afraid. Well, the good news is twofold. One, as they're going into winter, the brood should be going away and they don't have that place to reproduce. So that's step one, which is good. And then step two being if you're going to continue treating, you know, with a vapor based type of thing like oxalic acid or whatever, you would still be able to use that if you wanted to. So I hope that this does not create confusion or there's too much ambiguity in what I just said. I guess the key takeaway of the whole thing is most of the treatments you'd probably use wouldn't be all that effective. And even if they were, you wouldn't necessarily be able to measure. But if there is study or research that has been done, like if somebody did research on this in Florida where they can open the hives all year long, that doesn't really count because they're opening the hives all year long. You see, that's where it's really tricky to figure those things out. You'd almost have to have some test hives and then try different things. And then at the end of the season or at the beginning of the season, I should say at the beginning of the season, as you're opening up and you're doing those first tests, let's say 1 April, then you look at the numbers across the board to see if the ones that you treated all winter made a difference. If this is not helpful, whoever asked this, if this doesn't answer and it introduces too much confusion, message me and I'll try and do a better job later on. Okay, next one. Should I treat for Nosema or other diseases in the fall or just focus on mites? The only thing I do is varroa mites. That's the only thing that I'm testing, treating, and trying to address. If you see signs of dysentery, you see a lot of those, you know, kind of brown streaks going, and you suspect there may be an issue with either some kind of an infection, digestive infection, or Nosema, I definitely recommend doing it, you know, testing for that and testing for the presence of that. And you can certainly treat for it. Sometimes these treatment things can be a little bit trickier to track down. A lot of them have to be veterinarian prescribed. So that is something I would recommend you do early on, is establish some sort of a relationship with the veterinarian to say, hey, look, I'm a beekeeper And there's a few different medications that you would have to prescribe if I have an issue. Would you be willing to help me with this? And just kind of get that lined up ahead of time. But I don't prophylactically treat anything that I don't see. So if I suspect American foul brood, you know, I'm pulling everything out, burning it down. If I suspect something else, I make the adjustments within the frames, remove things, add things. But I don't just treat, you know, for the sake of it. The next one, how do I know if mite levels are low enough for the colony to survive? So this is something I've talked to somebody about this. I think it was in the Discord room the other day, and it might not even been in our Discord room, actually. There's another, there's one of our listeners who runs another beekeeping server. You know, I should mention it. I just don't know if he wants it public like that, if he wants to have kind of referral-based kinds of things, or if he wants it open to everybody. I'm sure he's listening to this, so you know who you are. Let me know, man. Shoot me a message and let me know if you want me to put out the information for your Discord room so everybody can see it. But he runs a great room and lots of information, people all over the world, lots of funny things going on over there, good Q&A. And the question to come up over there around like, hey, I got this, you know, this colony, and you know, back in August, they said that everything was good to go on the mite counts. And that's good. You know, thumbs up that your mite counts are good in August. But what I said to them was, hey, that's really cool, but what about March, April, May, June, July? Because, and you know, we talk about this quite a bit. I know some of you are like, God, Jeff, seriously, man, you're going to tell me the same thing again? I have to. So hugs and kisses, I love you. But I got to tell you this over and over again, because it's this important. If you say I'm going to treat, like I heard somebody say the other day, like, oh yeah, they recommend that we do this treatment in November. It's like, again, cool, right? It's not that November is a bad time of year to be doing things. Just don't forget all of the other stuff for the 7 or 8 months prior to that. So we have March, April. You've got a lot of brood, and I'm talking, you know, Northern Hemisphere here. So probably if you are in Australia, to all my brothers and sisters down under, hello, I hope you're all doing well. And New Zealand, of course, too. We got some New Zealand folks who listen. If you're down there, this is probably the time of year that you're getting really close to. Things are getting ready to start ramping up. You're going to have a lot of brood. And in that brood, the varroa is going to be like, yes, this is where I want to be. So this is when you've got to get aggressive. Now, some people are going to say, well, I never use oxalic acid because it doesn't get through the cappings and it won't kill anything in the cappings. That's true. But oxalic acid by itself is just dirt cheap. So when you use it, treat, and then treat again in 4 or 5 days, and treat again in 4 or 5 days, and treat again in 4 or 5 days. So you're going to have to do multiple rounds of treatments. I did the math on this. I posted it somewhere at some point in time. I don't know what it was. It was less than 10 cents per treatment. It's literally like a couple, 2 or 3 pennies per treatment. So for like a dime, for like 10 cents, you can treat, you know, 3 or 4 rounds, 5 rounds, whatever you want to do, and get anything that is still in the cappings will emerge, and you'll get them on that last treatment ahead of being capped. You'll get them beforehand, but you still have to be really aggressive with that in whatever your spring would be. If you ignore that in the spring, you're going to have all of these new workers emerge, and these drones particularly are going to emerge. And we talked about that in the last BeeBuzz episode, by the way. So if you haven't seen BeeBuzz or listened to BeeBuzz 29, go back and listen to that. We talked about drone comb and some of the things you can do with that as it relates to varroa mites. But you're going to have all these emerging workers and drones that are, you know, that have mites actively attached to them. And now they're spreading that within the colony. The drones that are drifting are also drifting into other hives. Mites are getting off over there. And you are becoming a problem. Like, you are the problem child of your community or your apiary or your area or all of the above. But let's say that, you know, you go ahead and you do a wash, and you're like, you know, coming right out of the winter, you do a wash and you're like, wow, you know, we're at 12 per 100. That's a pretty high number, right? That's a lot of mites. And then you ignore it. You're like, eh, they'll figure it out. And then you check again in, let's just say April or May. And you're at like 30. And you're like, we'll let them go a little longer. And then you hit June 15th, June 20th, and the numbers are through the roof. Like, you've got like 48, 50, 60, whatever it might be. Just tons of mites. And then, boom, you formic pro them. You know, you wait for that to go through its cycle. You start oxalic acid them, and you test them on August 1st, and there's no mites. And you're like, ha, man, my mite strategy kicks butt. We have zero mites. Yeah. There was something I was going to say, but I forgot we do have kids listening. I don't want to get myself in trouble, but you're going to feel like, you know, like you won, like you've got a little victory here. What you don't get to see is all the mites that have been feeding on your honeybees for the past 4 or 5 months. They're doing nothing but spread disease, right? It's not the mite itself. I would think about if you ever see, like yourself when you go into the woods, or if you see an animal that, you know, a wild animal, and they have ticks on them, right? The ticks themselves, yeah, they're sucking blood, and the animal, you know, with a lot of them, it certainly can drain the animal's energy and things like that. But it's not so much the parasitic loss of blood. It's what disease are they passing on? Like with ticks, you have Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and you have all these things. It's not like the bite of the mosquito that kills the person. It's the malaria, you know, things like that. So your bees can have a 0 or 1 per 100 mite count and be on the verge of death. Like you can have the whole colony completely collapse in November, December. And you're like, oh my God, what's going on? It must be part of this 60, 70% global losses thing. Yeah, it wasn't my fault. It was something else. You know, I treated with this thing and apparently it's not working. No, you're not working. You didn't follow the plan, right? You have got to be aggressive with this. And on this subject, we have a lot of people who have said this, you know, several times around, hey, I really hate the idea of killing 300 bees. Because remember, this is kind of the general rule, a half a cup of bees, 300 per half cup. You're going to use 300 bees to do your mite wash. And they're like, oh, I really don't like the idea of doing that. I get that. I really do. I believe that all life is precious. I believe that we want to preserve it wherever we can. But I also want you to look at it this way. And I've used this example several times. I want you to just think of the colony as a single organism, like a human being. And individual bees are cells, tissues, organs, right? All of those bees together make up the organism. So just like your body sheds dead cells and makes new ones, the colony as an organism sheds bees and makes new ones. Those bees will do anything to protect the colony, to protect the hive. You see it every time you do an inspection. Go in there and start rattling things around with no smoke, no protective gear, and see how quickly they let you know that you are not welcomed. They will give their life to defend the colony or to support the colony. If you said to them, hey, honeybee, we got this thing we want you to do. What do you say? They would probably say, hey, I'm a team player. Let's make it happen. I don't know if they would say that or not, but I'm pretty confident they would do that based on the other actions they typically take, you know, to support the colony. So don't feel bad when you have to do the washes. Think of it this way. If I don't do the washes, instead of losing 300, and let's say you're doing monthly washes, let's just say, and you do them for 6 months, you're looking at 1,800 bees. A queen bee in a flow in her prime can lay somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 eggs per day. So we're talking 1 day's worth of queen work is going to cover your entire season's worth of mite washes. So I hope that helps a little bit to kind of put that into perspective maybe. That first cup of coffee really sets the tone for the whole day. If you haven't tried an AeroPress yet, you're in for something special. AeroPress uses a unique brewing method that delivers a smooth, rich, and balanced cup of coffee with less bitterness. So you actually taste the roast, the origin, and the full character of the beans. Smooth, balanced, and full-bodied. It's like the best part of a French press, a pour-over, and even espresso combined into one compact brewer. And it's built for real life. Durable, portable, and consistently great whether you're at home, at work, on the road, camping, or traveling anywhere life takes you. Plus, it's the fastest single cup maker out there. About 2 minutes start to finish, including cleanup, so you're never waiting long for great coffee. AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer. Visit AeroPress.com/honey, that's AeroPress.com/honey, and use promo code honey to save 20% off your order. That's AeroPress.com/honey, promo code honey at checkout. So ditch the drive-thru, skip the bulky gear, and start your mornings with a better cup of coffee wherever you are. Big thanks to AeroPress for sponsoring this show. The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful, with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. When I was scrolling through their site yesterday, I actually ordered a retro 70s Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute t-shirt with Woodsy the Owl on it. It instantly took me back to my childhood. That's exactly the kind of things you'll find at Uncommon Goods. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. They have something for everyone. Plus, every time you shop, Uncommon Goods gives back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice with each purchase. They've already donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next order, go to uncommongoods.com/honey. That's uncommongoods.com/honey for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. Okay, do I need to replace old dark comb before winter or wait until spring? That darker comb, I want you to think of it as kind of like if you've ever seen like scientists and they like dig into the ice and they pull out this, you know, 100-foot piece of ice that dates back, you know, 400,000 years or whatever it was, and they can find things that were in the ice and in the water and in the environment 400,000 years ago. That's kind of the way that I equate comb. Comb is going to store the history of the colony, not in, you know, not in totality. It doesn't tell you everything, but it does provide you with information, and some of it can have no effect on the hive and not be bad at all and just be informational. And other parts of it can be really bad. There can be components of disease and things that are basically trapped in that comb. So it is a good idea to cycle the comb out periodically. Now, one practice for the longest time is a lot of places that sell nukes. When they sell nukes, congratulations, you're getting the frame with the old comb on it. It's not personal. It's just, you know, like, hey, you're getting a frame, you know, with this. In the old days, they used to be like, hey, you bring me frames and I'll trade you. And like, that's a bad idea, right? If somebody shows up with brand new frames that have never been used, like, okay. But swapping frames around and stuff from unknown apiaries, generally not a good idea. But you're probably going to get some older, maybe some darker comb. And don't think that just because you have dark comb that that's a problem. Like, you don't open the colony on this brand new nuke and be like, what is all this dark comb? I can't believe you did this to me. It'll darken up pretty quick. I mean, you put in brand new comb and they draw it up and it's nice and pretty and you have this beautiful, pretty comb and everything looks great. And then it rolls around to, you know, August, September, and you're looking at it and it's starting to darken up. And then by the next season, it's completely almost black, really. It gets dark fairly quickly. Where I really probably don't do a great job of this. It might not be a bad idea to write somewhere in a marker, you know, like 25 or 26 or something that kind of indicates when you put that frame into service. My rule is that if I make contact with a piece of the frame, if I push on a piece of the frame, and it's not pliable, because good, you know, comb needs to be pliable. If you push on it and it's really, really rock solid, that's when I'm like, all right, we got to get rid of this comb. So really dark, gets solid, no good. Now, in the winter, when it's cold and you have these frames outside of the hive, so they're being stored, you know, anywhere in your garage, shed, or wherever else, you do have to be really careful when you're moving and manipulating some of these frames, because they do get very brittle when they're cold. That wax can just break right off and it happens really easily. So I recommend kind of generically maybe saying every 3 to 4 years, you should probably be cycling them out. I know a lot of people who do it every 2 years. It's kind of a moving target for what people like to do. If you have some type of disease present and you've done the research and you're like, oh, wow, this is the type of illness that can be transmitted or retained in the comb, might be good, you know, good to go ahead and just put an X on those frames and start making a plan to cycle them out, you know, just as kind of a proactive measure. And cycling them out doesn't mean throwing them in the trash. You know, you could take a knife or a blade or whatever. If you're using all wax foundation, just cut out all the old wax. You know, a lot of people will take like a propane torch or whatever and kind of, you know, heat it up and put some high heat on it for a short period of time. You know, that can sometimes help to kill disease and illness. And I wouldn't say that's necessarily a foolproof kind of way of doing things. But if most of the issues are going to be within the comb, you cut that out and you're just dealing with maybe a little bit of residual on the edges. But, you know, hopefully that won't be too big of an issue. And you can always wash them. Again, some things can go through a soapy water rinse and wash and not be affected by that. But, you know, other things can. So just good hygiene and replacing them on some kind of a cycle is definitely not a bad way to go. Okay, should I tip the hive forward to help with moisture drainage? So we talked about this quite a bit in the past, hasn't come up as much lately. What I tend to do with my colony is, if it's possible to do so, let's say you have a single hive on a single stand by itself, I would cut the back legs about 3/4 of an inch longer than the front legs, as long as the stand was going on a flat surface. And that just helps for primarily anything. Like if it's, driving rain and it pushes a bunch of, rainwater up into the entrance, just kind of drains right back out. If you're filling a feeder and for whatever reason you spill some and it falls to the bottom, it can kind of run to, if there's an excessive amount, it can certainly, run out the front versus now, if it's just sugar syrup, they're going to drink it up anyway. But any kind of moisture that gets on the inside can kind of move to the front. Now, what's interesting is we've talked a lot about lately the condensing hives and the importance of the moisture. So, it's nice to have moisture in places where the bees can get to. It's like in a natural cavity where it would form at the bottom and almost make a little bit of a pool at the bottom they could drink from, or having it on the side walls. What you don't want is having it on the top, dripping down on top of the bees. So this is where a lot of times, if you just have a slight little tilt forward, any condensation could form on the top and then hopefully sort of roll forward and then maybe come down towards the front. I think it could help a little bit. I think you're better served, though, to focus on good winter hive body, the physical components. Hive management is probably going to serve you better and have more value to you than focusing on whether or not it's tilting forward. But again, I had one that was facing south and it was slightly tilted backwards. And what happened is a couple of big thunderstorms came through, pushed a lot of water up into it. And then there was the debris that falls down from cappings and things as new workers are emerging. And all of that was at the bottom board and it made this soup. And then the hive beetle went in there and laid some eggs down there. And then I had this bottom board with hive beetle larvae all over it, larvae technically. So hive beetle larvae were all over this thing. You want that to be clean. And that's kind of another reason why it definitely doesn't hurt to have a little bit of a tilt. Next, how much ventilation is too much in a cold climate? Hey, everybody, it's me. I am jumping in here. I was editing this episode and I did not answer this question correctly. The question I just read was, how much ventilation is too much in a cold climate? The answer that I gave, which was not the question that was asked, was how much insulation is too much? So I'm going to go ahead and answer the question, and then I'm going to leave my other answer on there. So to answer the question, how much ventilation is too much in a cold climate? You got to remember that when that cool air and the warm air inside the hive meet together, and they meet at whatever is the current air's dew point, that is the point at which condensation will occur. You want that to occur lower, below the cluster, versus up high. So if you have a lot of cool air coming in at the top, and you also have warm bees at the top, then that condensation will occur up high and drop down. So you want the condensation to occur down low. Now, if you look at the Hive Hugger package that Peg was talking about, I had somebody who ordered one, they received it, and it made a recommendation of having a 4.5-inch opening for the winter. I'm sure they've done the research and they've figured out that that's the best for them. I know she's up in Minnesota, so that's a pretty cold area of the U.S. Me personally, where I am, I usually leave mine at about 3/4 inch, but I don't have a Hive Hugger yet. I will have mine running in a test environment this year and a live environment going in winter of 26 into 27. So I'll have some real definitive data as to what works the best and how everything, comes together with that. But I would say based on the recommendation from Peg that probably 3.5 to 4 inch range is probably going to be pretty good if you're using, an insulated hive like that. And if you're not using the insulated hive, I would definitely keep it a lot tighter, maybe like in that 3/4 inch or whatever the smallest entrance would be on a commercially available entrance reducer. Now I'll go back and you can hear me answer how much insulation is too much. I feel like you're not going to have too much. I think the recommendation, and we had Peg on just the other day, R10 on the sides, R30 on the top is a good target across the board. I think, you can definitely get away with less on the sides in a lot of places. Don't skimp on the top. If you want to go to R50 or R60 on the top, have at it. But at a minimum, probably R30, R40 will do in most places. And again, if none of that sounds familiar, go back and check out episodes 175 and 176. Should I wrap my hives with tar paper or insulation or leave them natural? So there's a lot of people who wrap them with a tar paper because, one, that was kind of all that was available to provide any kind of insulation years ago. But two, they would have a deep snow and they didn't want the woodware just completely saturated in snow, all winter long. So they would do a wrap for that. I would defer to your local bee club and see what they're doing in your area. But if you're doing any kind of insulation, you know, put your insulation inside and then wrap around that. But also try to see if you can make sure that whatever is on top comes over. You know, so put everything on the bottom on first, whatever you're doing on the bottom and the sides, and then make the top wrap over and around that. That way you don't have moisture and things getting behind and then getting really nasty and funky, you know, between the paper and the foam and the whatever kind of insulation you might have and the sidewalls of the hive bodies too, or the hive bodies themselves. Is it okay to move my hives closer to a windbreak this late in the year? I've not done this. I think having them near a windbreak is not a bad idea. See, the whole thing is those winter bees, a lot of them, some of them have foraged, a lot of them have never foraged. But if you move them in the yard 100 feet, 200 feet, 400 feet, you do run the risk that some of them that come out on a warm day, they end up going back to the other location. So a little bit of a risk with that. The two things I can recommend for you there is, one, move them earlier in the season, right? So obviously, this is specifically asking right now, is it too late? Move them earlier in the season. Or option two, move them somewhere else. And then, see, this is where it's harder, because I was going to say move them somewhere else for a few weeks and move them back, but they're not foraging. So if they're not foraging, their lifespan is going to be extended for a very long time, which is the whole point of having winter bees. So you don't get to move them for a few weeks and then move them back and then everything is fine because the foragers who knew the old location are all dead. That's not the case now. So I think my recommendation probably would be to move them earlier if you can. If you cannot, I would actually wait until it's a little bit cooler. Wait until those temps are, see if I can get my math right. So I think it's going to be 50, you know, anything under 50, so 45, 47 degrees Fahrenheit. And then I think you're looking at like 8 or 10 Celsius, somewhere in there. Once those temperatures get down to, let's say, between 3 to 5 Celsius and 42, 45 Fahrenheit, they're not flying. That might be a good time to go ahead and move them. And then as you get through the worst of the winter and you're getting ready to get to, you know, the very beginning of spring, very end of winter time frame, then you can go ahead and move them back. If nothing else, just try to, you can orient the physical hive itself. So if you can't get the move done, let's say right now the opening is facing southwest and you just think, man, I really don't want anything west. Just gradually rotate it, you know, thinking of looking down from above on the hive and thinking about the hive body right now, if it was facing, again, if it was facing due southwest, and just keep rotating it on the horizontal plane, you know, like a couple of inches every time over the course of a couple of days. And they'll, you know, like I said, they'll figure it out. They'll reorient. Now, if it's a time when they're not flying at all, they will get a little bit confused, but at least they land back on the same box and there's no others around, right? If there's 10 of them around, it's going to introduce confusion. If it's just the one, you know, it shouldn't be a big deal. Hopefully that answers the question. Can I open the hive in the winter without chilling or killing the bees? So your biggest risk typically with a lot of cold coming in, it's not so much the risk to the live bees as it is to the to any brood that might be in the colony. They aren't typically raising a lot of brood when it's really cold. They will occasionally, you know, raise a little bit here and there, and they keep that close to the center and close to the cluster. The problem is they use a lot of energy to get the entire contents of their hive body or their cavity that they're in to a perfect temperature. And this temperature is going to have a range of somewhere between, you know, in some more extreme climates, maybe as low as 50 Fahrenheit or so, you know, the low 8 to 10 Celsius, and as much as 90 Fahrenheit. So 27, 28 Celsius, I think it would be. Is that right? I think somewhere in that range. So, it, you know, it's going to have a kind of a wider range. You open that up when it's, say, 0 Celsius, 32 Fahrenheit, you open it up, you're letting all that heat escape. And they will quickly begin to, you know, to generate heat, and they've got to consume more resources, and they've got to work for a while to get that heat back to where it was. So is it going to kill them? No. If you open up and you look in, you're like, wow, look at that. A lot of cold air goes in. It's going to cause them to use more resources. And obviously that is what could potentially kill them, is if they have to use too much resource repeatedly. because you keep having to go in to look at nothing. Because the whole thing you got to think about is, okay, it's January in the Northern Hemisphere. It's January. You open the hive, you look in, you see something. Oh no, what are you going to do? There's not a whole lot right now. A lot of people like to open it up because they like to look at the food stores and see where they are and start slapping pollen patties and different things on. I would, again, I've made the argument several times. My position is, why didn't you do that 6 months ago? Like, you have literally the entire spring and summer to get them ready for the fall and the winter. Plenty of time. So get the job done at the time of year the job needs to get done. And that's kind of my advice there. All right, everybody. Well, finally, I have made it through the what I guess has become a three-part series on the bee buzz that I thought I would get done in one. Hopefully my voice is getting back a little bit. I'm still completely smoked and exhausted. Whatever this is just, it's in my lungs and it's wearing me down and it's just a real pain. But we finally got through these questions. So now we got to figure out what we're going to talk about next, but we'll get something teed up for you here. Hopefully Thursday. If not, we'll talk to you again on Monday. If you have any questions, you know where to find me. Take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.